is from A.B. Dickerson, Poems on Representation on the City. It tends to give a, what he thinks of as a late Wittgensteinian reading of Kant. So he suggests that the argument that I've in here that we've got for the necessity of the categories, and this is exactly again the argument, why do I think the categories are necessary? How do we unpack this? So we've already got something like a minimal transcendental deduction. I'll explain why we don't have a real one at the end of the hour. I'll tell you why I've just given you 2 hours of a red herring, but I don't want to disillusion you yet. Let's believe this for the next 40 minutes, and then we'll learn why we should disbelieve it. So he says, and I think this is the structure of the argument I've been trying to lay out, necessarily, a spontaneous act of synthesis can result in a judgment with a claim to objectivity, that is, the cognition, only if the synthesis is governed solely by what is essential to the cognizing mind. So that's the answer about you have to kind of get around you. So it has to be essential to the cognizing mind qua cognizing. Well, the argument that we're facing in the metaphysical deduction is that the cognizing mind is essentially a judging mind. Hence, the essential structures of the act of judgment are the logical functions listed in the table of judgments. The table of judgments occurs in paragraph 9 at A70D95. And I'll say something about the number of categories in a minute, but let me just give a brief accounting of what those things mean. Judgments have quantity. And he says that universal particular singular, that is, universal judgment is all S is P, particular is some S is P, and singular is X is P. There is relation, and it turns out circle relation, because it turns out that really we only need relation. But anyway. And they can be either categorical, which is a relationship between two concepts, that's S is P, hypothetical, which is really a relationship in a sense between two judgments. Because it's the judgment that X happens, and then you say, X happens, but if X happens, then Y happens. So really the hypothetical form of judgment is a way of relating two judgments themselves, namely X happens and Y happens. And it connects them by the format if then, and the disjunctive is again a relation of several judgments, either X happens or Y happens. Or Z. And then modality. Modality is terribly messy here, but what he means is the value of the popula. And the value of the popula can either be problematic. It's possible that S is P. Assertoric, S is P. Or apodictic, certainly. And S is P necessarily as we stated. And finally, judgments can be affirmative, negative, or infinite. That is, we can say Bernstein is moral, affirmative. Bernstein is not moral, that's negative. Or if you're kind and in a fairish mood, you can make it infinite. Bernstein is non-moral. Those are your categories. So, step three, then, the essential structures of the act of judgment are the logical functions, especially in the table of judgment, necessarily. A spontaneous act of synthesis can result in a cognition only if the synthesis is governed solely by the logical function. That is, we have no other ways of putting concepts together to talk about the world, that is, to get knowledge of the world, other than via these logical forms. The logical functions, step four, insofar as they govern the synthesis involved in cognition, are the categories. Therefore, necessarily, a spontaneous act of synthesis can result in a cognition only if the synthesis is governed by categories. Ergo, if our cognition involves a spontaneous synthesis, then this synthesis must be governed by the categories. So, the gap, right? Notice what is this little argument trying to do? It's trying to bridge the gap between spontaneity and objectivity, and the bridging of the gap is via the essential features of the mind, right? In terms of judgment, and then the categories as what are the non-arbitrary concepts we must make use of in order to judge in accordance with the logical function of judgment. Kant's own way of doing this, the metaphysical deduction proper, is at B105.
You probably missed it.
Yep, right there.
In the margin here, the metaphysical deduction. This is it. Just this one little paragraph. And it's typical of Kant that there's a whole lot of palaver before and after. And the actual argument is that seven almost incomprehensible sentences. The same function which gives unity to the various representations in a judgment. So the same functions that I use to connect circle and red in the judgment, SST, gives unity to the mere synthesis of various representations in an intuition, namely the features of my intuition of the circle. And this unity, in its most general expression, we entitle the pure concept of the understanding. So we're getting the idea of unity within you. And of course, that's what I've been bearing a lot of. Unity to be here. The same understanding through the same operation. By which, in concept, by means of analytic unity, it produced the logical form of a judgment, also introduces a transcendental content into representation. This is the maneuver, I'll read it again in a second, but the movement here from the logical form of judgment to transcendental content is what I'm entitling the movement from transcendental grammar to transcendental semantics. Again, I know I sound like I'm making this up as I go along. A little rationality behind it. Today. So, the same understanding, meeting forces, syntax and semantics hang together through the same understanding. Through the same operations, by which I cobble together judgments, is equally the way in which I introduce into the intuition, a transcendental content. By transcendental content, he means simply an a priori form. Substance property. That's the transcendental content. By means of the synthetic unity of manifold in intuition in general. So that any old intuition is going to on this account, we are entitled to call the representation pure concepts of the understanding and to regard them as applying a priori to objects, a conclusion which general logic is not in a position to establish. General logic just studies judgments, right? You kind of read Aristotle on judgments, you know, hold it. But this is not an argument in Aristotle. This is an argument that belongs to transcendental philosophy, and it claims that from the transcendental grammar, we introduce a transcendental content. And what that content generates is what we mean by world. Kant's way of saying this is at D128. First, I shall introduce a word of explanation in regard to the categories. Typical Kant, you've been slogging away for, where are we, 128 pages? 130. We don't even know what a category is yet. he said, oh, okay, let me give a word of explanation of what I mean by category. Thanks a lot. They are concepts of an object in general. That is, they give us the very idea of what we mean by what it is for something to be an object. An object is something that we get through judging the world, and an object is the sort of thing that is a substance with properties that exists in causal relations with other objects, in space, in time. They are concepts of an object in general, by means of which the intuition of an object is regarded as determined in respect of one of the logical functions of judgment. So categories refer to transcendental semantics. They are concepts of an object in general. And what can we do with that? They are allows us to make use of the logical functions of judgment. So, once we regard the world categorically, then we are simultaneously able to make use of S and T, or if and then, or either this or that. Okay. So, a couple of puzzles here about how this works. The first puzzle, let me just stop there, I'm kind of chatting away. You all get the kind of shape of this argument.
Concepts
substance, causality, and composition or wholeness. That is, the relational categories are the only categories. And what they all share is that they are categories of different kinds of world unity. That is, the unity of properties in a substance, the unity of substances at a given time, the unity of the world through time by cause and effect. So it's how the world hangs together or is connected with its various parts. He sometimes thinks that maybe those three aren't enough, because we probably need some idea of reality and some idea of magnitude as well. And those who care about all of this tend to think that five is a good number. However, and here's why all this is almost irrelevant. Because the structure of Kant's argument is much more elegant and beautiful than that. Roughly, he's going to have an argument, we're going to call it the transcendental deduction, that's simply going to show, not depending on the notion of logical forms of judgment, that there must be categories. So the transcendental deduction is simply going to be an argument of a form like on your handout, only with different premises. Right? Namely, premises of unity on the whole. So the transcendental deduction in its both A and B deductions are going to be simply arguments, again, to connect spontaneity and objectivity by showing we must have some categories, and then in the analogies of experience, he's actually going to make independent arguments for the categories that we need. That is, he's going to defend the ideas of substance, causality, and reciprocity or commonality, as well as some of the other categories in the anticipations and the like. So, deduction, there must be categories. That's all that happens in that long, turbulent thing. But without the question-begging premise, namely, we know the logical functions of judgment, although arguably even hang with the notion of judgment, we'll see. And part of the mystery of Kant's deduction is what are the premises? What's the conclusion? But roughly the argument's going to be getting from subjectivity to objectivity. There must be categories. So the shape of the argument, as we've been finding in, moderately continuous. And then separate arguments for the categories we actually need. And therefore obviating the necessity of saying anything about the original table of judgment. Okay. There are two further issues. One further issue, and then I want to do another little twizzle. I've been watching the skating, so I'm interested in twizzles. if you're lucky, maybe at the end of the lecture I'll do a triple foul count. I love the language. A twizzle and a triple foul count. Who could ask for more? I have suggested that the movement runs from transcendental syntax to transcendental semantics. However, there are at least suggestions that Kant has a slightly different way of thinking about the relationship between the logical functions of judgment and the categories, namely that the categories are extra logical constraints that enable the logical functions of judgment to operate. So rather than, as it were, so the thought here is simply that rather than reading the transcendental semantics off from the logical functions of judgment, which is what I've been doing, the argument is something like that the world can be judged only if it is conceived under the categories, so that the requirement of extra logical categories is that it places a constraint on the logical functions of judgment, rather than the logical functions of judgment determining the categories. Just which you do. So one is extra logical constraint on the use of the categories, which allows for a slight separation of the two structures. The other, you read the categories off from the functions of judgment. Now, all the work, either way you do any of this, I simply want to underline that all the work is being done here is being done by the way in which forms of judgment unite representation. And that's why I say one of the things I made maybe too little of is the fact of, let's call it component, that the whole is come. To say that, as I said earlier, there's nothing we can do with concepts except use them in judgment, is to say that the whole precedes its part. And therefore, the notion of unity, in a sense, is what's going to be driving this story. And eventually that notion of unity is going to be, have something to do with the unity of itself. Exactly what is the mystery, but what is something to do. At this point, however, he's merely claiming that certain types of unity are essential to both judging into what is judged, and that the model of that unity, that forms of unity, logical unity, semantic unity, provides a model or a clue about the relationship between syntax and semantics, which you can require in either direction. It's called mutual determinism. On the other hand, so far, and now we can see the depth of Gabe's question, the notion of unity here is simply borrowed from the table of judgments. S is P, if then. So those are our models of unity, but as it were, those things are operating as primitives And to that extent, this would be just a conventionalist argument. So he hasn't yet got anything that would move to a real quid juris beyond a quid factor. So that, so the roughly, what's missing here, and the reason I said my entire argument was a red herring, is he hasn't justified the word transcendental here. Because, for all we know, these are just conventional ways of talking, conventional ways of thinking, and they're not necessary for a cognizant mind. That said, I want to make at least one further argument, which will tie up this week with last week. If my conception here of transcendental syntax and transcendental semantics is meaningful at all, it already indicates an overcoming of subject-object dualism. Which would be interesting if that was the result already. And therefore, it would be already a displacement of all epistemology. And the demonstration that Kant was not an epistemologist. Well, how does that come out? Well, if judging is the minimal action by which we get hold of the world, and that we have no account of objects independently of our judgment of them, then Kant is denying that there are subjects and that there are objects and that there is a puzzle about how they get connected. In the world of Kant, there are no subjects and there are no objects. There are judges and objects of judgment. So to be a subject, in this instance, is simply to be a judger. Right? Already, right, I'm giving you a functional account of the subject, not an ontological one. For all intents and purposes, what it is to be a subject is to be a judger, and therefore what it is to be an object is to be an object of judgment. And that, given what I've said about transcendental semantics and transcendental syntax, we may say that these two notions, judger and object of judgment, are internal correlates. Right? They mutually define one another, not mere external relations. So that for Kant, there's no question about how do I, as a subject in the world, get a hold of objects in the world. No. The notion of world is going to be defined by objects of judgment. Namely, our, now going back to Kant's vocabulary, our concept of an object in general. So the reason why, and this is why I also think that most of a lot of the readings of the critique are wrong, if it's right that he thinks this relation is internal, then what he wants to do in the deduction is indicate the nature of this relation. not explain how two independent things are connected, because they're not two independent things. Think of it this way. In accordance with traditional epistemology, what kind of account of representation does Kant have? And I'll give you some choices. He can either be a direct realist, an indirect realist, or an idealist. I think he's one of the three. Why isn't he a direct realist? Collins, in his book, thinks he's a direct realist. We know Kant's not a direct realist because he's a representationalist. So that one just drops out automatically. But to claim that he is an indirect realist, indirect realist believes that I infer from my being in a representational state that the world is in a particular state of affairs. And Kant does not think that I have to infer from my judgment anything about the world. So that can't be right. There's only an inference from my judgment that the world is such. How about an idealist? An idealist says that an awareness of an idea gets its reality by the constructive act through which it is coordinated with other ideas. But that just cuts us off from the world. So Kant can't be that kind of idealist either. Well, let me draw an analogy. I'm going to borrow from this. An analogy is simply this. If you're a representationalist, you have to begin with the fact, and this we're discussing outside, that I am affected by the world. And therefore, there are modifications of my mind. And that those modifications of my mind are the representational medium. So the representational medium here, and this is an analogy, are chalk marks on a board. That's the representational medium. The stuff, right? The mark. Now, what I actually see is a face. I see the face through the mark. I want to get that phrasing right. I do not infer the face from the marks on the board. I do not construct the face from the marks on the board. And I'm not aware of the face independently of the marks on the board. The marks on the board are my representational medium. But what I see through those marks, or in the representation, is an object. Right? So a face is not made up of marks. A face is made up of nose, eyes, and mouth. So the parts of a face are not the parts of the representational medium. They're parts of an object. Good Husserlians will like this very much, because essentially now, right, I'm arguing that the object of judgment is an intentional object. Right? So representationalism is the thought that I have representations. Representations are modifications of my sensibility. Kant never doubts that. Through the logical forms of judgment, I spontaneously see them as a face. The face is the object. So roughly, the categories are the mechanisms through which we go from Marx to space. That's the analogy. And that's why Kant's a representationalist, and that's why we are immediately aware of objects in the world. Because what we're aware of is what we see through our representation, right? I don't see that. The face is like the object in the world, not something in my mind. The in my mind would be simply the marks on the board. That's the analogy. The face, object in the world, modifications of mind. Okay. I know the quick pitchleans have to go before they get in trouble and I get in trouble. We will pick up with this sort of stuff next week. If you haven't yet got me your face,